This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Botswana is home to an estimated 200,000 Zimbabwean immigrants, the majority in the neighboring country illegally. Embassy representative Francis Chimina said it was important to issue the travel documents to ensure the immigrants' safe travel and screening for COVID-19.
That's Mokondisi Dube reporting from Habrone, Botswana. Details coming up. Also, aid workers remain concerned on the refugee situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region. And due to a number of factors, the world's oceans are in crisis. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A range of nations, including Germany, Tunisia, Panama, are banning travelers who have recently visited Britain or South Africa. The travel restriction is an effort to prevent the spread of two separate genetic mutations of COVID-19 in South Africa and Britain that are believed to be responsible for a recent surge of infections in those countries. The ban that started today is temporary and applies to passengers from Britain and South Africa entering these countries by air, land, or sea. On Tuesday, the European Commission recommended that EU states drop blanket bans on travel from the UK to allow essential trips and freight. EU states, however, control their borders and can ignore the recommendation. EU ambassadors met yesterday to start building a unified approach and work out how to eventually lift the border restrictions with Britain, including a requirement of tests on all arrivals. The variant virus in South Africa appears to cause somewhat more severe illness among younger adults and spread more rapidly, but South African Health Ministry officials say it does not appear to be more lethal. The UK mutation seems to spread more rapidly. The World Health Organization has said the UK virus does not appear to be stronger than original versions of COVID-19. Botswana and Zimbabwean authorities have reached an agreement to issue special travel documents to thousands of Zimbabwean illegal immigrants. This will ensure the migrants undergo COVID-19 screening to exit points as they return to their homeland for the Christmas holiday. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokondisi Dube has the details.
The Zimbabwe embassy in Botswana said illegal immigrants will be allowed to return home using special travel documents. Botswana is home to an estimated 200,000 Zimbabwean immigrants, the majority in the neighboring country illegally. Embassy representative Francis Chimina said it was important to issue the travel documents to ensure the immigrants' safe travel and screening for COVID-19.
We have opened the way for them because my argument was, yes, if you don't allow these buses to pass through, people will use undesignated entry and exit points. Now, there are a lot of dangers with that. One is that COVID, they don't go through tests.
Most of the illegal immigrants use undesignated points to enter or exit Botswana, thereby avoiding COVID-19 screening. Zimbabwean immigrants in Botswana, like Stanley Ncube, have welcomed the move to issue special travel documents.
We appreciate the initiative taken by our Zimbabwean embassy to facilitate emergency travel documents for our people in order for them to cross at regulated border posts. This is a welcome development because it will help both countries to screen for COVID.
However, there are concerns that some immigrants, most who survive through odd jobs, might not afford to pay 350 bula or $35 required to acquire the special travel documents.
The downside of it is the costs attached to it. This document will cost 350 bula, and a lot of people that are outside Habrone, faraway places, will need to come all the way to Habrone to access the embassy in order to access this service. The costs might prove too prohibitive for some that will end up going the traditional way of crossing in ungazetted points, and this will be undoing this good initiative.
Botswana's COVID-19 Presidential Task Force Chairperson Gereng Masupu said security along the country's border has been beefed up and warned against illegal crossings. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
In Cape Town, South Africa, a former police captain is facing charges of possession of child pornography and indecent assault. The 65-year-old was arrested at his home after his son discovered boxes of homemade child porn there. His son alleges he was in some of the movies and suspects 21 other children were filmed. On Facebook, he says it's taken him 30 years to expose his father, but he needed to do it for closure. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to Dr. Shahida Omar from the Teddy Bear Clinic for Abused Children.
Shahida Omar says it's not uncommon for child pornography to be made by family members. She says the adults use it as a way to groom youngsters for later sexual abuse. Omar says as an indication of what happens in the home, they've seen an increase of sexual abuse during the coronavirus lockdown period.
During the lockdown, we saw that, you know, one would expect the statistics to be low because children were kept indoors and they were not allowed outside because of social distancing. And yet we saw that there was an increased incidence of sexual abuse, where the assumption was that they are safe at home. Unfortunately, it has proven to be otherwise, that children are at risk, and usually they are at risk and being preyed upon by people who are known to them, somebody they have a relationship with.
Omar says if you suspect your child may be exposed to sexual abuse, look out for sleeping and eating disorders.
Unruly, disruptive behavior. A child that was previously very lively and robust and fun-loving and engaging suddenly just goes into a state of total withdrawal. So one needs to unpack those layers and see what is actually going on here.
She says children must be taught about body parts and boundaries from the time they can talk. Omar says communication is key.
The more a parent talks, the more permission they're giving the child that it's okay, I'm your safety net. If anything happens or if you feel uncomfortable about anything, you know you can come to me.
She says when a child speaks out or the abuse is discovered, the parent's response is extremely important.
When that first responder finds out about it, it's about validating the child, acknowledging that it's not the child's fault. One needs to actually really applaud the child for their bravery and courage, because we don't know what kind of threats have been handed out to the child. You know, your family will suffer, you will be blamed for it. So that initial point is actually critical in ensuring that moving forward, the child will not be compromised.
And how can sexual abuse affect people in later life?
For me, the most outstanding challenge that we see in relationships is the trust issue, the betrayal, the deceit, somebody that they loved, somebody that they expected to protect them and ensure they're safe, actually betrayed, all of that. That was violated.
But Omar believes that with good therapy and the right support, there is hope.
As ugly and heinous the crime of sexual abuse is, you know, many children have actually bounced back with a force, because children have resilience provided they are given the necessary supportive mechanisms or crutch to continue. Of course, you cannot erase or eradicate that experience, but you can actually enable them to cope with whatever stresses they face in the future, any triggers in the future that may evoke those same emotions. They would be able to deal with it constructively without collapsing into an emotional heap.
The former police captain's son says he decided to speak out about the abuse publicly to raise awareness during the 16 days of activism for no violence against women and children, which wrapped up worldwide on December 10th. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
A UN investigation into violence in Mali indicates that both security forces and militant Islamists committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in the country. The French news agency AFP reports that it has seen a copy of the report, which has not been made public. AFP says the International Commission of Inquiry, a three-member panel investigating events in Mali from 2012 to 2018, made the allegations in a 338-page report. Mali descended into violence in 2012 when ethnic Tuareg separatists launched an insurgency in the north of the country. Islamist militants then overtook the ethnic clashes. In 2013, former colonial power, France, launched a military campaign against the militants, but they have regrouped and expanded their campaign not only in Mali, but into neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger. Since then, thousands have died and hundreds of thousands have been forced to flee their homes. An advocacy group says it is concerned about the reports that Eritrean refugees in Ethiopia are being forcefully returned to conflict areas inside the country or being sent back to Eritrea where they've fled from. Sarah Miller is a senior fellow with Refugees International, and she spoke to VOA's Salem Salamone.
So there are, as you said, just under 100,000 Eritreans that have been a longer-standing population in the Tigray region. Of course, there has been UN and NGO assistance. The government had been previously to the conflict, relatively active with this refugee group. But obviously now conditions have really deteriorated. We're finally getting a little bit more access, but the UN has also been reporting very low supply of food, medical supplies, fuel, all of the concerns that we've had. There's very little resources that refugees would have to survive, which is why we're seeing so many starting to leave the camps, and it's for their own safety and survival. So many of them have taken on foot or whatever means they can to go elsewhere in Ethiopia or even to eastern parts of Sudan. What the concern is that there is a right to flee for your life no matter where you are, and the concern is that they are being pushed back, forced back into those camps, into an active conflict zone, or, as I said, back into Eritrea, which would be worrisome. But the humanitarian situation is very serious.
What do they tell you, these refugees that are seeking refuge in Tigray? What are they running away from? And also, are humanitarian organizations reaching out to the Ethiopian government? Or also, are they reaching out to the Eritrean government to seek or find some sort of answer? Because from what we've heard, the Ethiopian government has said they are the ones who are supposed to be taking the lead in even giving shelter to refugees or immigrants coming into these regions or places, especially in time of conflict.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because until recently, the Ethiopian government has worked relatively closely with the UN and other organizations working with their longstanding refugee populations. Ethiopia hosts some of the largest numbers of refugees in all of Africa. So in a lot of ways, Ethiopia was getting a lot of positive attention for the way they had been dealing with their refugee situation. So this particular crisis and emergency is sort of a 180 from the narrative that we've had about Ethiopia and its refugee hosting relationship. Yes, ARA, the agency from the government that handles refugee matters, has generally taken the lead, but the UN and other NGOs have always been quite active. So, you know, I think refugees first and foremost right now are seeking safety, and there's not a lot of security from either, whether it's Ethiopian forces or the TPLF or other groups that they're seeking safety from. And so I think that's where access really becomes the biggest priority. The UN and other NGOs having access, able to get aid in, so that these people can receive some much needed assistance.
All right, just before I let you go, what are humanitarian organizations demanding from the government of Ethiopia? Are you also seeking some sort of answers from, if the allegation is being returned back to Eritrea by, I don't know who's facilitating that, and if you have any information? So what are you demanding, one, and who do you think is responsible for doing this? Thank you.
Yeah, I think a very clear answer would be no actor, most clearly the Ethiopian government, should not return a refugee to a place where they would be in danger, whether that is inside of Ethiopia in the Tigray region, which is an active conflict zone, or into Eritrea, where they may face persecution, forced conscription into the army, other types of human rights violations. So that is the clear, resounding demand from most NGOs in the international community. Then I think we would go back to the really important issues of humanitarian access, which would include, you know, really respecting the humanitarian corridor, seeing aid workers as neutral parties, so they're able to provide access, medical assistance, food, water, et cetera, to the refugees there. So I think those are the clearest demands. I think Ethiopia, you know, has generally been viewed as a strong, stable partner in responding to humanitarian crises in the region. And so for them to reestablish their leadership in this, they need to reaffirm their obligations under international law, under their domestic law, on how they treat refugees and other displaced persons.
That was Sarah Miller, a senior fellow with Refugees International, speaking with my colleague Salem Salamon. The Ethiopian government has said there was no civilian casualties in its military operation in Tigray last month and has denied allegations it has failed to protect refugees or internally displaced persons. However, access to Tigray is limited and those statements cannot be confirmed. The offensive in Tigray began November 4th after the government said members of the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, had attacked national military facilities. The government says the operation is aimed at certain TPLF leaders, but the TPLF says it is a war against Tigray. Due to climate change, pollution, overfishing, and other factors, the world's oceans are in crisis, and therefore, so are we, and indeed, all living things that depend on the ocean for food and other necessities. Although marine and climate scientists have been sounding the alarm for decades, policymakers have usually privileged short-term economic growth over the long-term health of the seas. To help address the emergency, the leaders of 14 coastal nations, including Kenya, Ghana, Namibia, Norway, Canada, Chile, Indonesia, and Japan, have formed the High-Level Panel for a Sustainable Ocean Economy. It explicitly links the development of best ocean sustainability practices to their economies and the future welfare of all peoples and the planet. To find out more about its work, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with marine ecologist Jane Lubichenko, the distinguished university professor at Oregon State University and one of the Ocean Panel's leading scientific advisors.
The 14 global leaders that have come together as the Ocean Panel have really focused on the role of the ocean for each of the nations involved in the panel, as well as people everywhere. They recognize that the ocean's health is at risk from pressures such as climate change, overfishing, and pollution. And the Ocean Action Agenda really brings a holistic approach to ocean management.
What do you mean by holistic?
Currently, most management is very sectoral. Fisheries are managed by one minister, water quality by another minister, oil and gas or renewable energy by another minister. And the sector by sector, issue by issue approach is part of the problem. We have to be thinking about the cumulative impacts of all these activities. And so the bottom line for these 14 leaders are the three P's: effective protection, sustainable production, and equitable prosperity. They go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. And so they set out to develop a set of recommendations that could deliver a sustainable ocean economy.
What is new about the Ocean Panel's approach to an ocean economy?
Part of what they are doing is understanding that the old framing of having to choose between a healthy environment and a robust economy is absolutely false. The new Ocean Action Agenda that they are proposing, if it was realized, could provide as much as 6 times more seafood than the ocean does at present by 2050, and as much as 40 times more renewable energy by 2050. It could lift millions of people out of poverty and contribute as much as 1/5 of the greenhouse gas emission reductions that are needed for the Earth to stay within the 1.5 degree centigrade target of the Paris Climate Agreement. So that's pretty impressive and pretty exciting mission that they are on.
I know the Ocean Panel issued 74 pledges to achieve their goals, but perhaps chief among them is the promise by each country to develop and implement a sustainable ocean plan for their own national waters by 2025. That seems like a lot of lead time for something so urgent.
In reality, 2025 is just around the corner for something as big and bold and ambitious as a sustainable management plan for an entire exclusive economic zone. But they are also committing to a suite of other actions that will reform fisheries to make them more sustainable. But we can also be restoring the important nursery areas that these ecosystems provide. And these ecosystems provide barriers against storm surge and coastal erosion.
What else?
They are also committing to clamp down on illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, which is super destructive. And they are also addressing the flow of trash, pollutants, plastics, nutrients from the land into the ocean, and to tap the power of the ocean to help reduce carbon emissions and address climate change.
The Ocean Panel only represents 14 of the 189 countries that signed the Paris Climate Accord. How is that enough to really make a difference on the crises that the oceans are facing?
The 14 represent 40% of the coastlines of the world, 30% of the exclusive economic zones of the world, 20% of the fisheries, and 20% of the shipping. And you sum up the size of all 14 exclusive economic zones, that's an area about the size of Africa. So these 14 countries are actually pretty big players. And now we are realizing it is possible to use the ocean wisely rather than using it up, but only with bold, smart actions. And that's what these 14 countries are proposing to thrive.
Marine ecologist Jane Lubichenko is a leading scientific advisor to the nations that make up the high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The first direct commercial flight between Israel and Morocco took off yesterday, marking the U.S.-brokered normalization deal between the two countries. U.S. President Donald Trump's son-in-law and advisor, Jared Kushner, was on board the flight from Israel to Morocco. Kushner is leading a delegation from Israel. The two countries established full diplomatic ties earlier this month as part of a series of U.S.-brokered normalization accord with Arab countries. Morocco joins the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Sudan in normalizing relations with Israel this year. In return, the United States has offered them military trade deals and other favors. Washington recognized Morocco's annexation of disputed Western Sahara. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.